Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today, our very special guest is Helena Norberg-Hodge. She's an analyst of the impact of the global economy on cultures and agriculture worldwide, and a pioneer of the localization movement. She is the founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture, based in the U.S. and U.K., with subsidiaries in Sweden, Germany, Australia, and Ladakh. ISEC's mission is to examine the root causes of our social and environmental crises while promoting more sustainable and equitable patterns of living in both North and the South. Its activities include the Ladakh Project, a local food program, and global-to-local outreach. Today, Helena is on the soapbox to talk about her new documentary, The Economics of Happiness, that is playing to standing room audiences all over the world. Helena, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. And I just want to let you know that my activism, of course, has been against the war, against the empire, marching, you know, yelling, taking my little bullhorn to D.C., getting arrested. And it hasn't really put a dent into anything that, you know, the empire, the U.S. empire is doing. So recently, really as far back as 2009, I had the idea that we need to recreate revolutionary communities. And it's basically the same exact thing that you talk about in your movie. And so, you know, I just want to hook up with these movements, make the movements more global and widespread. But first of all, for my listeners, I'd like you to define globalization and say why it is so harmful to especially the environment and local cultures.
Well, globalization as an economic process is about deregulating global trade and finance. And what that means is removing social and environmental protection that inhibits big banks and big corporations from doing harmful things to the environment and society. So it really is a very, very destructive process economically, and it's what has made so much activism meaningless, because all the time while we were working to fight the wars or to protect the environment, to try to, you know, lobby for labor union rights or reduce third world poverty, without us knowing it, governments were in the process of giving more freedom to the giants, who were getting bigger and bigger, more powerful, more and more wealthy. And of course, the whole war machine is a central part of this.
Right. talk about how the free trade agreements, the so-called free trade agreements, very Orwellian named, processes, how do those contribute to this globalization?
Well, globalization is happening at the level of free trade treaties, so-called. It's about freeing up global trade at the expense of local trade. So the process of globalization happens through these treaties. Many of them are bilateral, just between two countries. And then the big corporations had the idea of setting up the WTO to make the whole process easier for them, to get a whole bunch of governments to agree to give them more freedom in the name of these free trade treaties through multilateral treaties. So this is what globalization is. It's trade treaties that give these giant multinational corporations more freedom. Now, what many people don't realize is that at the same time that this is going on, local trade and local businesses are being ever more heavily regulated, very often over-regulated in the most ridiculous, absurd ways. So we have this crazy way that we are deregulating the global players and over-regulating the local players.
Well, and then that, of course, leads to environmental degradation and environmental waste. And I did watch your movie The Economics of Happiness last night, and I really loved it, and I'm going to do what I can to spread the word about it to, you know, all my contacts and colleagues and friends. But something that I never, ever knew or never even thought of is this trade that happens between nations. It was something like, for example, Great Britain exports almost the same amount of milk as it imports. What's
exactly
the reason for that? That doesn't even make sense.
No. And, you know, I just want to add, too, that the U.S. exports about 900,000 tons of beef and veal and imports about 900,000 tons of beef and veal. So this is a completely general process that is the consequence of these so-called free trade treaties. Now, if you stop to think about it, if tomorrow around the world people sat down to eat breakfast and ate food from the region, well, very few multinationals would make any money, but thousands, if not millions of businesses and farmers would make money. So there's this structural relationship between this concentration of wealth in the hands of giant traders and this crazy, crazy trade where it's a routine thing now that that governments and nations are importing and exporting the same product. You have oranges from California in Australia at the time when the oranges are ripe over there. And the oranges from California in Australia cost less than local oranges. In fact, I have studied this around the world, and I looked at butter, and I found that butter in Nairobi, in Kenya, from Holland, costs half as much as butter from Kenya. I found that butter in Spain, everything you could buy virtually was Danish and Dutch butter. In Denmark, I was served butter, you know, made in France. And in the UK, the butter from New Zealand costs a third of the price of the butter from the farm down the road.
Wow.
Now, this pattern is something that I first had my eyes open to in Ladakh or Little Tibet, where butter from the other side of the Himalayas was coming in over the high Himalayan passes with all that diesel fuel, all that transport, transported for about 5 days, and that butter costs half as much as the local butter. So I started studying this process and realized that it's linked to this fundamental part of the economy, which is the idea that we should always be increasing production for export rather than increasing production for our own needs.
Well, and then many people don't have the resources to shop locally, and as a matter of fact, probably don't even think about buying local products, especially if they cost, you know, twice or three times as much as the imported products do.
That's right, and I've been working with a lot of the organizations, you know, that work on food, like organic farmers organizations and so on, and often what they've been saying to the consumer is, you know, if you want good food, healthy soil, healthy farms, you've got to pay more for your food. I've been trying to get the message out, no, let's expose these hidden subsidies. Our taxes are paying to ensure that food from the other side of the world, that's triple packaged, processed, irradiated, refrigerated, flown, you know, 10,000 miles,
mm-hmm.
costs less than food from a mile away. We're not going to be able to compete with those hidden taxes and subsidies. So we've got to start exposing that and demand policy change.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, in this process, the petroleum companies also get their share of this globalization pie by, you know, filling up the airplane tanks, fuel tanks, and the train fuel tanks, and the truck fuel tanks, and the boat fuel tanks.
Absolutely. And again, it's just so sad, because if we don't look at this, we won't understand why it costs much more to go by train than to fly, why it's often cheaper to fly a longer distance than a shorter distance. Even when they decided to do away with the stamps for posting things between airmail and by road, That was a huge subsidy for the big global businesses mm-hmm. and worked to the detriment of smaller local businesses. All of these things are not going to be changed overnight, but I think if we understood that right where we are today, we have a choice between blindly supporting a path towards globalizing, which means corporatizing our world, or localizing, which means a multitude of medium-sized, even national-scale businesses and smaller local businesses. We can move in one direction or the other, and if we start supporting the process of localization, we'll see that it brings with it enormous social, environmental, and even psychological and spiritual benefits.
Well, I do want to talk about the localization movement with you, but it seems like the anti-globalization movement is very strong and very militant. You know, the protests that happened whenever the WTO or the IMF or the G8 or G20 get together, it, globally, anywhere they are, it seems like the protests can be very large, they can be very militant, and of course they can also be violently suppressed. And so what part do you think that these protests play in the anti-globalization movement?
Well, I think that, first of all, the media, as you know, doesn't cover the number of articulate and clear and very highly qualified economists who are speaking out against globalization.
Mm-hmm.
So in the media, you see the more militant side. I mean, many people really think of anti-globalization people as being, you know, black-hooded boys who are burning mm-hmm. cars and throwing stones. So this is a very, very unfortunate thing, and which is why it's so wonderful that you're doing a radio program, because we so desperately need alternative media to really get a real sense of what's going on in the real world.
Right.
But there's also, I think, because of that, I feel that there's a huge need for education as activism, which again goes hand in hand with alternative radio, to start a discussion to get more awareness so that we increase the numbers of people who have a very clear understanding, not just of what they're against, but also what they're for.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, right now, education and awareness is the strongest, if you like, weapon we have. But I'd like that to be used with a great deal of compassion for people who are trapped inside a worldview or institutions that are very destructive. I don't think this is a problem of good guys and bad guys. I think it's a problem of ignorance, above all. I remember so well, you know, seeing Alan Greenspan after the financial crisis sitting there on television saying, you know, yes, I thought that free markets, you know, that this path was the right way, but there's obviously a flaw. We need some regulation. Well, really, that's one of the main messages of the economics of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we do need to regulate trade, but not just trade in money and speculation, but trade in water, in food, in plastic. And they're completely linked, and we need regulation. We need business to adhere to the laws and rules of a particular place.
Well, talk about briefly about, you talked about Ladakh, and is that how you pronounce it?
Ladakh, yes.
Ladakh, a little Tibet. Talk about how the culture was before globalization, and then talk about the culture post-globalization.
Well, Ladakh is this westernmost part of Tibet, and it belongs politically to India, but it's up on the Tibetan plateau, and it's culturally and if you like, environmentally Tibetan. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual head, and so on. This area was closed off for political reasons, and so it was suddenly thrown open to the outside world. And I came out as one of the first Westerners in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
I was a linguist, and I learned to speak the language fluently and was able to witness what happened when that area was thrown open to the global economy. And I, because I spoke the language, I was very aware that part of what happened was a huge psychological impact. When I first came there, people were among the happiest people I had ever encountered. I'd never seen people who just had this sort of vitality and joy, just totally unlike anything I'd experienced. And over the years, I came to realize that that joy had a lot to do with a deep sense of self-respect, and how that in turn came from, especially as a child, being loved and appreciated by a lot of people around you. You know, every mother had about 10 live-in caretakers for every child. So the child was constantly surrounded by caring arms and people looking after it. That built this sense of self-esteem and a love and a sort of caring for other people as you grew up, because you'd had so much love as a child. I saw how these people were so confident, were affected by the outside economy, and it was very clear that it's the children that are affected. They're so vulnerable, and even in Ladakh, these young children got the impression that the Western consumer culture was superior to their own culture. They suddenly started feeling that they were ugly, that they needed to be taller, have lighter skin, and have all the products of the Western world to be somebody. So this is a very important thing to understand about how this consumer culture is spreading. I also saw that suddenly, literally within a few years, the outside economy created unemployment. And it was partly by bringing in all that subsidized stuff from the outside that was selling at a lower price. So the destruction of the local economy was the destruction of local jobs. This is a really important thing to understand, even in America today. And then, of course, the other thing that happened was that all kinds of pollution that had never existed before were created. All kinds of illnesses that hadn't existed have come to Ladakh now. Doesn't mean that it was paradise before, but people were healthier physically and psychologically. There was no unemployment, strong community, and a much healthier environment.
Did your work there lead to your happiness economics, which I really love the idea of happiness economics? Tell my listeners about what happiness economics is.
Well, basically the economics of happiness is the path that supports a rebuilding of community and a rebuilding of the connection to nature where we live. It's a shortening of distances also, so that there's a reconnection between production and consumption, not at the tiniest, smallest village level necessarily. It's a relative term, but we urgently need to shift in the direction of localizing instead of globalizing. Localization is the economics of happiness, because it is the economics that allows us to reconnect to the real source of our wealth, which is, you know, the natural resources on which we all depend, and the human beings on which we depend for labor and for work. When you create a system where you're either as a producer or a consumer sitting on one side of the world, and you're dealing with things on the other side of the world that you never even see or know about, how are you going to behave in an ethical and responsible way?
Mm-hmm.
What's happened is that globalization has been marketed as a way of bringing the world together. It's actually tearing us apart, because it's creating so much competition for scarce jobs. And at the same time, what globalization is doing is, at every step of the way, these policies are encouraging businesses to use more energy and technology instead of people. So we have both a loss of jobs, because people are being substituted for with machines and energy, as well as cheap labor somewhere else. Localizing is about starting to rebuild a fabric where we start slowing down. We don't blindly just keep using more energy and more technology. It's about reflecting on where that technology is needed and useful. I think the best example, and probably the most important example where we can understand localization, is to look at food and farming. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say quickly, you know, that there's nothing else that we produce as human beings that every human being on this planet needs every day of the year. That's food. You know, we don't produce our water, which is equally important. But this food production is being treated exactly as any other production. Farmers are being pressured to produce apples and chickens just the way they would rubber balls or bullets.
Right.
It's insane. When you localize, you suddenly start helping farmers to diversify, and they employ more people, but because it's on small, diversified farms, the work is very enjoyable. It's not like a huge monoculture where you stand all day like a machine, you know, picking the same thing. So there's a, if we can just understand that this diversified economy, the local economy, provides more jobs while reducing pollution, then we'll understand why it's the economics of happiness.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on. I know you don't feel well. I know how it is traveling around the world when you feel well, and it's even worse when you're ill like you are. But
yeah.
You had a showing in Berkeley, and I heard from other people, because I know a lot of people in Berkeley, that you turned away 500 people. Of course, Berkeley is its own little special area. But how is this message being received in the United States, where we are so consumeristic, we are so materialistic, where it seems like what we own is more important than what's inside of us or inside of our hearts? How in general is this message received here?
Well, it's been very, very heartening. We've been amazed. We had the first launch in Seattle, and the organizers up there thought we would have to cancel because there was a snowstorm coming in, and people had been told that they should go home early, leave their offices.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we had to turn away more than 100 people. It was just, and it was hugely enthusiastic welcome. In Australia, the same thing. It was sold out when we showed it in the Sydney Parliament House. We're getting it in London. It's going to be February the 8th, and it's already almost sold out for 700 people. So we're getting a very, very good response. We feel really encouraged.
Well, I think it's because, the global economy is starting to frighten people, even people who don't pay attention, and there is a lack of positive leadership. You know, we here in America see, oh, Michelle Obama planted an organic garden, but there's no leadership to show us how. Of course, they don't want us organizing in our local communities, localizing our economy and our environment and our communities, because that is, like you said, it's bad for the profits of the global companies.
Yeah. And by the way, in the business world, it's really exciting with new business alliances and new chambers of commerce, where once people really understand this whole agenda of localizing, it's really exciting what's happening. In many cases, by supporting small local businesses, they're revitalizing jobs, rebuilding community, and there's a lot of evidence about how that's reducing the polarization that's going on in every society now. You know, left and right, and people angry at environmentalists because they think it's the environmentalists that are threatening their job.
Right.
Once people become more economically literate, you suddenly start people start coming together. And there is this practical path that we can take right now by joining the localization movement.
Well, tell my listeners a website that they can go to. I was really excited about your Get Active link on your website. So give my listeners your website.
Oh, thanks, Cindy. It's the economicsofhappiness.org. So they spell out T-H-E, theeconomicsofhappiness.org. And there are lots of links, lots of materials, people need to think about this a little bit to see the multiple benefits. And above all, they need to start looking to find the examples of localization. And they'll really understand why it is the economics of happiness.
Well, and I just want to tell you that my idea of recreating revolutionary communities is getting a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. And so I hope that we can work together to really spread this movement. And, you know, it's very exciting. It's an exciting time to live in. And I just, you know, wish you well. And like I said before, we'll spread the word and do what we can to, you know, make this world a better place. And actually, localization and local activism is way easier than national, international activism. It's
cheaper, right,
and it's better.
Yeah, but you know, I do want to stress that what's happening is that the local activist groups are linking up, you know,
yes,
partly through people like you. So when we have many small linked up, we're more powerful than trying to be one big.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the cell idea.
Yeah, so this is true in business, it's true in activism, that many small are more efficient and more powerful and more happy.
Well, I totally agree with you, Helena Norberg Hodge. Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we hope you feel better. Take care of yourself, and we'll do what we can to work together to make these communities strong and stronger.
Thank you. I really look forward to working with you.
Okay, feel better. That was our guest, Helena Norberg Hodge. Her work just really dovetails nicely with what we're starting, recreating revolutionary communities, like we talked about in the interview. Well, that was Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guest, Helena, and mostly of all, you for listening. I hope you tune back in next week.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
get up now. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell and keep yelling, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore! Just get up from your chairs!
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.